the invitation to be here. It's an honor, pleasure to be here for this thematic year. Let's start with perhaps one of the simplest problems that we'll be hearing about this year, and also one of the oldest. It's about material that you probably all first saw in undergraduate classes, and I certainly wondered about it at the time, and I think it's since been a surprise to me to find that a lot of the things I've always wondered about really weren't known. So so this is perhaps one of the basic systems of field theory and continuum mechanics. I want to find a vector field V which has given divergence and curl, and in particular I want to know what is the right boundary value problem, or what are possible boundary value problems for this system. Okay, so the motivation for this is actually the recent development of computer codes, both in fluid mechanics, computational fluid mechanics, and electromagnetic field theory. What happens is that you repeatedly have to solve these problems. For example, in fluid mechanics, if you're given the vorticity of a fluid, and usually if it's incompressible, divergence is zero, and you want to work out what's the corresponding velocity. In that case, if the fluid is viscous, you're given all three components of the velocity field on the boundary. If it's inviscid, you're just given the normal component. And in each case, given the vorticity, you'd like to work out what's the well-posed problem for finding the velocity. And in electromagnetism, this arises in a number of different cases. All of Maxwell's equations are expressed in terms of divergence and curl. And there are a lot of problems. There have been a lot of problems in getting electromagnetic codes to work. And the reason that they don't have the problems that they've had arise from the fact that they don't know what the well-posed problems are. And it turns out that the well-posedness of this is involves a lot of different things which you might not expect. Okay, so I was first interested in this because of the problems with reconstructing velocity from vorticity in fluid mechanics. And historically, most of the work on this has been for either of two cases. If omega is zero, so that you have an irrotational flow or potential flow, that gives you either irrotational flow in fluid mechanics or electrostatics, and that is thoroughly developed subject. There's huge literature. But real fluids and magnetic fields and time-dependent equations do not have omega zero. Okay, now, also this system, in many, especially in electromagnetic field theory, should be written in terms of differential forms. And all of the theory that I'm going to describe could be, I could use differential forms. There are two reasons why I'm not. One is the fact that quite often in fluid mechanics, for example, the V is going to be a contravariant field, not a covariant field. Very often I should put in a matrix in front of one of those V's. I've got to assume that's the identity. The theory applies when it's not, as long as it's positive definite. And But really, one of those equations should be for a one form, and the other should be a two form in all of the, in electromagnetism. Okay, now this is a system of four equations, four linear equations with constant coefficients in three unknowns, and the in order to have a solution, there always is, you must always have a compatibility condition amongst the data. Okay, so the obvious compatibility condition is that the divergence of omega is zero, and when omega is all of R3, this condition is necessary and sufficient, and you can write down the solutions, it's written down in every physics textbook, in terms of the Newtonian Biot-Savart potentials of the divergence and the curl. And just for notational purposes, we say a field's irrotational if its curl is zero, it's solenoidal if its divergence is zero, it's harmonic if it's both irrotational and solenoidal. And let me point, the reason for the definition is, of course, that if phi is a harmonic function, so then grad phi will be a harmonic field, as its curl is zero and its divergence is the Laplacian of phi. However, there are harmonic fields which are not don't arise as a gradient of harmonic functions, and they are actually quite hard to characterize and to work with, but very essential. For example, the field, the field of in the Taylor-Couette flow, the flow between two rotating cylinders, basic field there is a harmonic field which is not a gradient. And the field due to a current, the magnetic field outside a current-carrying conductor, is also a harmonic field, which is not a gradient. So this is the basic issues here. What are the boundary and what boundary and other conditions on the data are necessary and sufficient to guarantee the existence and uniqueness of solutions? And typically, the sort of regions, the sort of situation I'm going to be concerned with, is you've got a region with a certain number of holes. Okay, so you can think of this as being some tomography problem. You've got a divergence and a curl, and you're given some combination of normal components of the vector field and tangential components of the vector field on the boundary, and you want to know, is it enough to guarantee existence and uniqueness of solutions? And the topology of the domain plays a role in the answer. Okay, so let me start by describing the situation for the Dirichlet-Diffkurl problem. This is the situation where we prescribe both of the normal and the tangential components of the field on the boundary. And in this case, okay, so we've got four equations, three unknowns, and here there are three pieces of boundary data. I'm going to assume that mu and nu here are such that the boundary data of the V is a there are extensions of the field to the interior, which are H1 functions. And little integration by parts shows that there are two necessary conditions. This one is just the divergence theorem. And this one, if you just multiply by a vector field, which is irrotational, and you get that that must hold. Now, this is includes a lot of different possibilities. If I take A to be the gradient of phi, and phi has compact support in omega, that implies the divergence of omega is zero. It actually also implies a boundary condition on the boundary, namely that the boundary divergence of eta plus mu is zero on the boundary. And this is a continuity equation on the boundary of the region, and this is equivalent to essentially to Kirchhoff's law on the surface. So this is easily obtained just by multiplying through by A. Now, those conditions, okay, so this is just a single constraint. Oh, and there are some other conditions. For example, if I take A just to be a unit vector in any direction, there are going to be three conservation laws that correspond to this one if I take A to be E1, E2, E3, the unit vectors in three dimensions. There are going to be three compatibility conditions involving the integral of omega I and eta I. Okay. Okay, so this problem, as far as I can tell, the first results on this were due to Borges and Saur and von Weil in about 1990. And they did a Schauder theory for this using single and double layer potentials. And in 1998, I developed a variational approach to this. And basically, under the necessary conditions, there is actually a unique solution. And the proof, which I'll outline, it involves three parts. And the main part is the middle part, in which I describe a decomposition of H01 of omega into a gradient subspace and a curled subspace. In order to describe what happens here, this notation is the usual notation for subtle spaces, and this says they're vector valued. The crux of the matter is, what is this space and what is that space? There's tremendous non-uniqueness in the decomposition theory for fields, and what I'd like to do is get a decomposition which is equivalent, which is orthogonal, and it turns out that once I do that, the problem just falls apart. Okay, the inner product here, I'm using the V and W are inner product are two vector fields. The DC inner product is divergence of V, divergence of W, plus curl V, plus curl W. And this is an equivalent inner product to the usual H1 inner product on this space. Okay, so how do we determine these spaces? The way to find them is to use what I called the reverse Riesz lemma. The usual Riesz projection theorem on a Hilbert space characterizes closed subspaces or projections onto closed subspaces in terms of a variational principle. Namely, if V is a closed subspace, the projection of H onto V is given by that minimizer of that problem. However, if you don't know the space is closed, as here, you have that it will be closed provided that this problem has a solution for every H. Okay, it's a very, very simple exercise in Hilbert space theory. It's leave it to you to do. And so let's see how this works on the space H01. Okay, so if I take that space with the DC inner product and let V be the set of all gradients, well, I want to choose the okay, I want to take gradients of functions with such, with the property that their normal component is zero, their tangential component is zero on the boundary. So these are three pieces of boundary data. You're not going to be able to just take the functions to be in H1, but if I also require the Laplacian of phi to be in L2 and the normal component to be zero, which is, that's a well-defined trace result as long as this is true, and then take X0 to be the natural Hilbert space and a product with respect to this, then let's calculate what that variational principle says. I want to show that for every V, this is going to give me, I've got divergence of V squared, so it's divergence of V minus Laplacian of V. And this is a variational principle. Given V, I want to find phi that obeys this. Okay, so this is a nice quadratic functional. It's convex, weakly continuous. And the only thing that you have to prove that is that it's coercive. And that is a standard inequality that this is coercive on this space. And hence, for every V in H01, there is a minimizer of this. And hence, this is actually a closed subspace of H01. There is a similar, much more complicated construction for the allowable space of vector fields. And in the case of the vector fields, while the phi over there is unique, there's going to be a large subclass of fields A in here. So I don't require uniqueness in this result. V hat will be the best approximating curl will be unique, but the potential that gives that curl will not be unique. Anyway, this lemma gives the decomposition, and the minimizer of this field, the minimizer of that problem, so if we had to minimizer, the Euler-Lagrange equations are that the this is zero for every psi in x zero. From the quadratic form, that's quite easy to sec. And if you ask, well, what's the weak equation that corresponds to this? This means that phi hat is a weak solution of the biharmonic operator on phi equals the Laplacian of divergence of V subject to, okay, phi is zero and dp nu. So we have the biharmonic operator here because of doing the integration by parts here. It's going to do two integrals, and you apply the Laplacian on this whole operator. So the scalar potential for a field where I have want both the normal and the tangential component of the field on the boundary to be zero, as up there, has to obey a biharmonic equation, not the standard Poisson type equation that you ordinarily get. So the interesting thing about this is really that the if you try and set up the the problem in using the reverse Riesz inequality, it actually tells you what are the right spaces for the potential. There's a similar, you get a similar result for the curl part of the potential. You're going to get an operator curl to the fourth. Okay, so that's curl of curl of curl of curl. A is equal to curl cubed, sorry, curl squared of omega, plus some boundary conditions. And again, it's a well-posed elliptic problem, but it's going to be fourth order. And in order, and it follows from this decomposition by choosing the right spaces to get these to be closed subspaces. Now, one of the points about this is the scalar potential just depends on the divergence of V. So this, the divergence of V just determines this part of the solution, and the vorticity just determines, or the omega just determines this part of the solution, because this equation has this type. So the this decomposition has the extra effect that it completely separates the scalar and vector potentials. If you use any other form of these equations, you get mixing. And that's historically has been a problem both for numerics and for any analysis, is that you get mixing of potentials. But if you're very careful about how to choose this, the decompositions, and use orthogonal decompositions, you can separate out the problems. Okay, so basically, if they're necessary conditions, then it's sufficient, and the solutions can be found by solving variational problems like those over there. Okay, the next case. Are there any questions or comments? Okay, well, that's the situation if I have three boundary conditions. If I just assume the normal component is given, that's just two scalar boundary conditions on the boundary. I could also just take the case where the flux is given, the normal component of the field is given on the boundary, and that's one boundary condition. And you can ask, well, what's the well-posed problem in this case? Okay, and as we'll see later, this is the right trace condition. Okay, well, if we look at that problem, then it's easy to show that this has a weak, if this has a weak solution, and in electromagnetism in particular, you expect there to be solutions of Maxwell's equations which are discontinuous. So the statement, whereas you do, and you also expect them to have finite energy. So requiring the solution to be L2 is the right one, and they're the finite energy solutions. And if you multiply by A, you get exactly the same compatibility condition we got the previous time. So this is a this includes a requirement that omega is solenoidal, and there's a differential equation on there. Okay, now this time, I'd like to do this, follow the same process as before to show that when this necessary condition is satisfied, then there is a solution. And this problem of tangential div curve problem dates back quite a while. I think there are various people Hermann Weyl did some work on this in the 1940s, and the various German mathematicians used single and double layer potentials to do a theory of the problem. In the 50s and 60s, and then about 1980, a German mathematician named Picard and a Finnish mathematician got some Hilbert space results using closed operators for this. Every one of them got them under much weaker conditions than I'm going to show here. Okay, so this time the idea is to try and express L2 in terms of potentials which also enable us to obey the boundary condition. So the boundary condition is the normal components given, and if phi is required to be in H01, that implies that the gradient of phi, tangential component of that, is zero on the boundary. Okay, because phi is constant on the boundary, so its tangential component is zero. And all the boundary information will be absorbed in A. And it turns out that in general, if I try and approximate any field, so that space G0 up there, is the set of gradients of phi such that phi is in H01. Curl of omega is going to be the set of curl of A such that A is in, okay, well, turns out that firstly, I can require not, well, let me just say. If I start with fields in here, without lots of generality, I can also assume divergence of A is zero and A dot nu is zero on the boundary. Okay, that turns out these two don't make any difference in there. And H tells you, and then you can say, well, what's orthogonal to basically every gradient here and every curl here? Well, just do a little integration by parts, and you'll find that if H is a harmonic field which satisfies that boundary condition, it's in the, it will be orthogonal to everything in here and everything in here. So that's Green's theorem. And this subspace is of tangentially of fields which are zero on the boundary, whose tangential component is zero on the boundary, is isomorphic to the second Durham cohomology group of the region. So if the region has three holes like this, the in this space or on this region, that space will be three-dimensional. And we need to find out exactly what that what a basis of that space is. But again, just as in the viscous case, the problem with this representation, it will decompose into three separate separate equations for the potential, the scalar potential, the vector potential, and the harmonic field. The only problem is the harmonic field is not determined by the boundary data. So when the region has more than one hole, which is, when you've got a region, you can ask how many connected components are in the boundary. These holes here have boundaries. Okay, so an exterior boundary sigma 0, interior boundary sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3. They're disjoint. And so that tells you the dimension is 3. And we must have extra data to determine these solutions. So no matter what we do, the boundary value problem is not well posed unless we also have some information that gives us H, the harmonic component. Okay, so the specific result is this. Okay, so this is recent. This is work with Jay Alexander at Case Western. Is there all of this? And it's not yet published. The requirements on the rho, that's the divergence of V, omega, the curl of V, is now L6/5. That's for the embedding theorems to work. And the necessary condition holds, then there is a solution, and it's defined up to, well, there's a J-parameter family of solutions where J is the dimension of the second cohomology group of the domain. And to have a well-posed problem, we must prescribe either the flux of the field through a surface which includes each hole, or alternatively, the line integral of the field along a curve joining two distinct components of the boundary. Okay, so in electrostatics, the second choice is called the, is what you probably learned in your first course in electrostatics, that you always have to worry about the potential differences of fields between conducting surfaces. Okay, so let me describe why that happens. Okay, so this is the space of fields, I'll call them H. H is harmonic, and H is wedged in at zero on the boundary. Well, a theorem that's a very nice exercise in Hilbert space theory is that supposing you're in L2, and these are always using the standard inner product. If I've got a weighted problem, there's a weighted inner product. If V is orthogonal to the gradient, then that implies V is a curl. And also the same thing, if V is orthogonal to a curl, teach your first course in Hilbert space theory and a little differential operators is a nice exercise. Okay, well, in this case, we can show that if H is in here, H has to be a gradient. Now, if it's a gradient, this condition implies psi is constant. But on the boundary, well, it's not constant on the boundary, it's constant on each component of the boundary. So, for each component, so if I've got a region omega, I've got a hole here, supposing I take psi to be, in fact, let's call it chi j, to be zero on the boundary except for chi j, and to be one on chi j, and then solve Laplacian chi equals zero. That's a trivial problem. It's got a unique solution. For the maximum principle, chi lies between zero and one, and the gradient of chi j is going to be in this space. Okay. from the maximum principle, you can prove there are most J such solutions where there are J plus 1 components to the boundary. And so this is a basis of the space of harmonic fields. So there's actually a very simple construction of all of the harmonic fields. Okay, so these functions are 1 here, 0 here, and any such field, basically, it's characterized, so a solution, if I know one solution, any solution is going to be of the form V hat plus H, where H is a linear combination of these. Okay, if I take all J plus 1 of them, they add up to 1. So the only solution, harmonic function that's 0, that's constant everywhere on the boundary will be 1. So they're only, although they're J plus 1 functions like this, only J of them are linearly independent. And so only J of their gradients are linearly independent. So we have this. Well, how do I find the CJs? Well, CJs can be determined essentially by knowing the line integral of the field between here and here. And that's a potential difference in electrostatics, is that if I add to the conditions where gamma J is a C1 curve from, say, sigma J to sigma 0, okay, sigma 0 is usually considered to be the ground, this is the electrostatic interpretation of the uniqueness theorem. So in order to get a unique solution of this, not only do you have to know the data for usual boundary value problems, but you have to prescribe J other pieces of data which depend on the topology of the domain, and they have an interpretation. So in fact, the way that potential differences, the mathematical interpretation of why you use potential differences in electrostatics, is that they come from the second Durham cohomology group of the domain. Okay, so if I do the same thing for prescribed normal component, you have to replace the second Durham cohomology group with the first Durham cohomology group. That means you have to count the number of handles in the region, not the number of holes. And every one of the, so in this case, the corresponding group of the corresponding subspace of harmonic fields has to obey this boundary condition. Its dimension is L, where L is the number of handles, and all of these are curls. And so they're both much harder to picture and much harder to interpret, or work out how to get the circulation around each handle, which is what you need to add to the ordinary data in order to have a well-posed problem. So what this is saying essentially is that if you've got if you've got the ordinary div curl problem, and either this is given everywhere or this is given everywhere, it's not quite elliptic. You have to add some topological information in general, or it's elliptic as long as the domain is topologically trivial, but, for example, there's no interesting magnetic fields in simply connected domains. And so in electromagnetism, where we often have that, the interesting cases are usually where the domain is not simply connected and we have to add extra data. And this is the reason why a lot of the codes haven't worked, is that they haven't known what extra integrals or what extra fluxes you need to prescribe in order to have a well-posed problem. So I think everybody who does the first course in electrodynamics tends to think, well, this is an elliptic problem of some sort, and all I need to know is boundary data in order to get the answer. That just isn't true. Okay, so the really interesting case, and most cases you don't have that the whole boundary is of one type. Usually you have part of the boundary is a conductor, part of it's an insulator or whatever, is to work out what happens if you have separate, have a mixed problem where the normal component is given some place on the boundary and the tangential component is given essentially on the interior of the complement. You can't give the, well, for mathematical regions, suppose you're doing one of these physiological experiments on somebody's head, and you put some caps on, and currents there, and you want to know, if I know the divergence and curl of the field in here, what else do I have to know in order to solve that problem? Yes. Oh, and in fact, in this case, and I'm only going to talk about the case where there's just one component. Actually, what's very interesting is if you just have two components, like the region between two spheres, and one is sigma tau and one is sigma nu, you actually don't have to add anything, which is, we're going to do the general case where any number of components of the boundary and any number of different parts of these, provided everything's finite. Well, I'm going to assume that they're smooth curves. And in fact, I think I right, yeah. That's an interesting thing, and surprisingly, it's not as singular as you would think. So I'm also going to assume that the different components are uniformly separated. They don't come arbitrarily close to one another. But the interesting thing about this is that you're prescribing these with either one or two boundary conditions. So it's a different number of boundary conditions on different parts. Okay. See that I'm running out of time. We get a somewhat different. Bob, I hope you'll excuse me that this is going to be the first lecture for you, so maybe you won't need it full time. Yeah, we do have somebody here after. Yeah. So, again, by just doing integration by parts, we get this. Now, here, and related to what Walter's just said, I'm using this notation. What happens, and what I think you're getting at, is H1, one of the whole issues in this theory is, of course, that an H1 vector field has the property that each dvi dxj is an L2. And I'm working with HDC of omega, which only requires that the divergence of V is in L2 and the curl of V is in L2. Okay, so this is 9 conditions. This is just 4 conditions. And in general, this does not imply, V is in here does not imply V is in here. However, this space, the sigma nu here, means also that yeah. when I put a sigma there, I'm imposing these boundary conditions in here and here. And a basic result behind everything here was due to Friedrichs in 1955 on a paper on differential forms. And he called this the main inequality of vector analysis. And he proved that there exists C greater than zero, such that, okay, so omega this is true for any V in, okay, so let me just say so this says, this is the condition that the tangential component is zero on the boundary, this is the condition the normal component is zero on the boundary. And so this is a Poincaré-type inequality, and in the process of proving this, he proved that on this space and on this space, the H1 and the HDC norms are equivalent. Okay, I've already used that. This result, as I said, Friedrichs proved and called this in 1955. Subsequently, Duveau and Lyons proved a version of it. Tamam and Foyas proved a version of it. And each of them did not cite any previous or give any previous credit or authorship. In some ways, Friedrich's version, you can't blame them because the paper is on differential forms, and the whole point of his article paper was to generalize this to arbitrary Riemannian manifolds in any number of dimensions, and he started off by doing this case. Now, it turns out that I've just proved that this is also true for any, if nu sigma and nu tau are like this, so let me call this sigma nu, that this theorem is also true, and that H1 and HDC are the same, for provided you've got this sort of complementary thing, and in particular, I need the distance, the separation of the sets. But that result is behind a lot of the coercivity. Okay, in this case, the orthogonal decomposition is like this. G sigma tau means that the grad phi such that phi is an H1 and phi is zero on sigma tau. There's no boundary condition on sigma nu, and so this, think about it, a lot of the related analysis involves mixed boundary value problems where it's mixed Dirichlet-Neumann data. Curl sigma nu, that's got to be the complementary set of the boundary, and then the harmonic fields have this right property. Okay, so we want to prove this space. We can prove this space is finite dimensional. When it's simply connected, the space has dimension m plus 1. When sigma tau has m plus 1 components, the dimension of the space is m. Basically, if you're doing that picture I had with three I've got three components for sigma tau on the boundary, these are three components. I need to define two line integrals, the potential difference between here and the potential difference between there and there, in order to specify the harmonic field. However, to find the curl fields is proving very difficult. Ordinarily, this is done by solving what are called transmission problems. And we have a conjecture for the dimension M1, but we haven't been able to construct the non-gradient fields. We know all the gradient fields, and they're essentially the same as we had over there. And Jay and I did an analogous problem in the 2D case and got the exact number in that case, but that's a lot easier. And anyway, the end result is that with this decomposition, and if you substitute in the problems for each one of these, the scalar potential and the vector potential, you get a elliptic eigenvalue problem. It's coercive, and there are unique potentials that solve it. The phi potential just depends on the divergence. The A potential just depends on the curl of the data. And so there is a unique solution up to the harmonic components. And so if the dimension of the harmonic components is M1, there's an M1 parameter family of solutions. And in order to find a unique solution, you need to prescribe M1 linear functionals, which give you the harmonic components. So this problem has a surprising amount of different mathematics in it, considering the simplicity of the way it's stated. Okay, I'll finish there.